Welcome to Sacred Realms. It's a great day in Hyrule, y'all. Welcome to Sacred Realms, a Zelda retrospective podcast. I'm your host, Lyndon Willoughby. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Matt Willoughby, but it is cause for celebration this evening because a glorious event has taken place in the canon of Sacred Realms podcast. The planets have aligned. I'm sorry, Matt, did you want
to? I was going to say, I feel like I'm reason enough to celebrate.
You're always here. You're mostly always here. We love you. We love you. You're great. You're wonderful. Please don't leave. I really don't want to start hiring for a new co-host.
Just do your thing.
And also, you're great. But as I was saying,
rude.
The planets have aligned, and something that has not occurred in many moons is once again before us this evening. And that is the convergence of your host, Lyndon Willoughby, your co-host, Matt Willoughby, and frequent friend of the show, Mike the Detective, back for the first time in a very long time. Mike, how you doing?
I'm fantastic. Howdy, y'all. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
We are indeed recording the day after Yuletide festivities. So, I think we mostly all three of us had the day off work today. So
that is a fact, and that is rare in my line of work.
Yeah, no kidding. So everything just kind of came together really well. We needed to record an episode, and we said, hey, none of us have work today. Let's close out this long weekend of festivity with a little bro time talking about Zelda. I think that that's always a good strategy.
I'm a little curious why they've never capitalized on Zelda's hat and just given you a red version with a little white puffball at the end.
We should be wearing Santa hats right now. Why are we not doing that?
Because this is an audio format.
Like, I mean, yeah, I can't actually argue. I have no argument against that.
I was going to say, think about who would benefit in any way at all from any of that.
Me.
I would benefit. Yes.
Yes, us.
Colleen looking at us from inside would
she would also
chuckle.
Benefit.
She
yes.
would. Yeah, exactly. How are your holidays, Mike?
They were fantastic. The family and I went and rented a cabin in Broken Bow.
Nice.
Cabined up, hot tubbed for Christmas. And the kids had a blast, so I had a blast.
Well, that's what it's all about. Matt and I as well had a great time hanging out with family, and good times were had by all. It was a very successful Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, and great times were had by all. And we hope that that is true as well of everyone listening to the show, whether you celebrate Christmas or not. And if you don't, then we hope you just had a spectacular, regular old weekend. But definitely hope that it was an edifying and a warm and fuzzies sort of weekend for all of you. But of course, the pod never sleeps, except for the rare instances in which it has slept for a week. This isn't one of those weeks. We're back to talk about another section of the game that we've come to play. And I am personally very excited about this because, interesting bit of trivia, our guest for the evening, El Detective, he had played this game before I had. Long before I had, actually. I had not played this game to completion until about halfway through college, and you had experience with it far before that point in your life, right?
Far before. So I think y'all determined it came out 2002.
Yeah.
This was a 12-year-old Detective Mike just doing his thing on some goofy-looking game that he grew to love.
So with all that being said, it's interesting that, you know, definitely nice to have somebody whose experience with this game precedes my own and Matt's. So I guess as we've been doing with all the other guests that we've had on this season, we would love to catch up with you on your history with Wind Waker and just sort of what your feelings were on the game before restarting your playthrough. And then after we talk about that, we'll get briefly to the specific way in which you're doing this playthrough, which is different than anyone else we've had on the show so far.
Well, Lyndon, I remember it like it was almost 20 years ago.
Not to put too fine a number on it.
And so I did get this pretty much right after drop. I had become indoctrinated into the love of Zelda by this point. And so this game came out. I don't remember.
Did your house have a GameCube?
We did. We had GameCube, I think, directly prior to this. What year did GameCube drop?
2001, I believe.
So I probably got GameCube for Christmas, and then this was probably one of the first games that we bought after we got it, if I remember correctly. And so I know that you had talked to Josh about kind of what his method of play was in that early years. And so I was absolutely not allowed to play on any weekdays. If my mom caught me with the game system on during the weekdays, that was a paddling.
No one wants a paddling.
No one wants a paddling. And so I was allowed to play on the weekends, but I was only given 2 hours to play on the weekends. Mm. So being an enterprising young 12-year-old gentleman, I decided that my parents didn't get up until roughly 8:30 or 9 o'clock. So anything before that didn't technically count as time played if done correctly, if you catch my drift. So I would wake up at about 4 a.m., 5 a.m., sneak into my brother's room, because even though he was younger, he had the game system in his room. Mm. And then while he slept, I would get some Wind Waker in.
So you definitely adopted sort of a Josh from ZU approach to your game time.
Yes. Great minds think alike.
Gotcha. Cool. Yeah. I can't remember the last time I played a video game at 5 a.m, but it's definitely not something that I do often.
Well, it was so easy whenever you have the youth.
Are you saying the youth has fled us?
It has fled me so rapidly. When I hit 30, it was a brick wall. But yeah, I had the staying power to get up, play that prior to my Saturday morning cartoons, and feel just fine the rest of the day. I think if I tried to get up early for a video game now, I don't honestly know what would happen. I think that I'd probably explode.
What would happen is that you would play for 30 minutes and then a baby would wake up and then you would feel like you got absolutely no return on that half hour investment that you put into it.
That was disturbingly accurate and hits me where I live.
Well, it hits me where I live too. It's weird how that happens. But all that is to say, so played it pretty much from the moment that it was available. What were your kind of opinions on this game as the years went by? And I guess it's important to mention what we were talking about earlier, which is that you actually did one of these times that you played the game, you did not successfully make it all the way through.
Correct. So the first time, I guess if you break it up, I technically did beat it my first time through. But so I started the game and I was not a fan of the graphics going into it. Like we kind of already talked about on here, I saw what the potential was going to be for Zelda, and then I saw this. I'm like, what in the Saturday morning cartoon BS am I getting right now? Which I love Saturday morning cartoons, and I came to love this game. But I was not a fan of the art style. It was a little goofy for me, even at 12. Like, I thought some of it was a little bit, like, overdone. But then once you get into the gameplay, the characters, like, that all kind of melded into the background for me, and I didn't detract from my enjoyment any until I got to the Triforce quest, which I think you're talking about next week. Mm-hmm. And so I won't get into it too much for this episode, but that was such a slog trying to get up at 4 or 5 a.m. on the weekends and think you're going to make some progress in the game, only to be told, no, you got 6 more of these gosh dang maps to go get. Mm. So I petered out and probably let this game sit for 6 months or so, and then eventually went back and didn't want to start over all the way, so I then beat it for the first time. And after I got past the Triforce quest, sailed on through, and then several years later in high school, I played it and beat it a second time, and just kind of knew that I'd have to get through that part. Kind of like when you read Harry Potter and you get to Order of the Phoenix, where it gets dark and kind of slow.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely didn't finish that book in my first go either. Mm. So similar for me.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely kind of see. I can see the parallel for sure. And as somebody who has played the game in its GameCube version as well as its Wii U version, can definitely understand where you were at, because I very nearly bounced off of it that first time I played as well. Because it's a complete momentum killer. You know, it's really tough. We'll talk about that a lot more next week. But all that is to say that does sort of bring us into what I was mentioning earlier, which is that you're unique in terms of guests that we brought on to talk about the show so far, in that you are playing the GameCube version.
I am indeed, in all its GameCube-y glory. I was able to bum a GameCube off of Matt. Thank you, Matt.
You're very welcome.
But he didn't have the cords, so I then had to hunt cords.
Which I thank you for.
Piecemeal this together, and then I've been able to play it, and it's definitely harder for me to play right now than the Switch games have been, because as we've talked about before, most of my time is that like 30-minute increment in bed where you're laying next to ye old wife, or ye young wife.
There you go.
Yeah, that's much better.
Brynn, if you're listening, I love you.
Brynn's not. We know that she's not listening. We don't have to worry about that.
No, in the rare case she gets this like 10 years down the road and decides she wants to do it, I don't want to be in the doghouse for something I did.
That's fair. You got to future proof.
Yeah, smarter. But so, no, it's been difficult because the kiddo is sleeping in the main TV room we have right now. So after he's in sleep, I can't play games in there, so we've hooked it up in our bedroom, and the wife doesn't want to see me play Zelda while she's trying to go to bed. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting some really interesting different play times in there, and just trying to keep up.
Yeah, and so actually, I did have a question about that. Since this is a non-HD console, which is being plugged into an HD TV with a HDMI-like converter cable, how are the – I mean, is it pretty muddy? Is it a little fuzzy looking?
Because I've already played it, and you know, I love the style now and I love the game. It's not detracting a whole lot from it, but it definitely, doesn't look as crisp as I've seen some of these, HD, you know, obviously the Wii U version, and even watching some gameplay footage from the original GameCube, it doesn't look quite so good.
Yeah, that's sort of what I figured. And I know it's not going to be quite this bad, but it's a similar thing to whenever you try to plug an N64 up to a big old modern TV for like a Mario Party night or something. You know, you get the converter and it's all like you get everyone sat in chairs 5 feet from the 65-inch TV, right? And it's weird, you know, but you're ready to roll. And then you fire it up and it's like, oof, man, this is these pixels, they do not look good. So I'm glad to hear that it's not ruining the enjoyment of your gameplay experience, at least.
No, it's not ruining. I mean, there have been some, listening to y'all talk, I've learned some things that are different between the HD and the GameCube that I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit in this episode. Definitely not quite as user-friendly or graphically friendly as what y'all have going. But you know what? We're getting there, and it's still Zelda.
No Swift Sail.
There is no Swift Sail. In fact, it's the slow sail. It's the slowest sail. And I have to take out my little baton and tune the wind every time I want to go a different direction, and it gets real old real fast.
Yeah.
I mean, and also, how many times did you have to listen to the command medley?
Oh, in the
in both temples.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah. A lot. A billion?
Yeah. So
minimum.
You know, whenever you, I don't know if you had a similar experience, Matt, but did you ever play like the old Pokemon games with sound on, and then you'd have the game off in a different room, and you would think that the Pokemon,
yeah, absolutely, yeah, like it would still be playing in your mind as this, like, yeah.
I've had at least two times in the last couple of weeks where I have been game console off in bed at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm like, oh shoot, did I forget to turn it off? I hear the song.
Yeah, it's not a great feeling.
Well, you know what that really is just Link is out there somewhere trying to possess your body for the purposes of clearing a dungeon. So
I'd be all right with it.
Okay, cool. Much as Medley and Makar are clearly just cool with this.
You possess the detective. No.
What's your special power, Mike?
I don't know if that's appropriate to talk about on the pod.
It's not. It's really not. I take it back. I never should have asked. Oh, man. Okay, well, cool. I mean, yeah, obviously there's a lot of stuff. I don't think this episode specifically should have too many points of discussion that center around the differences between these two editions of the game. The command melody is definitely one of them, but we've kind of gotten that out of the way early, so that's all good to go. I think the only thing that's really left to discuss here, Mike, is to ask, you know, where would you say that you have ranked this game against other Zelda games that you've played?
We don't want to know that yet.
No, we always talk about like going into it. Where do you
okay.
I am not looking to get ahead of the recap episode here. I just want to know like going into all of this, where is he at with it?
Got it.
So if you would have asked me before I fired this up, where would I think that Wind Waker would land on my continuum of Zelda? I would say probably in my top five, below, of course, Ocarina, and in my head behind Majora, probably maybe top three in my head. Going back and playing, I'm having a really fun time. But I'm trying to be a little bit more analytical in about different aspects of it, how much I'm enjoying it. Yeah. So we'll see where it shakes up in the recap.
Yeah, absolutely. Can't wait. But I think that's basically everybody except Matt, who's come on this season, has basically said the same thing, which is that previous to being on the show, if you were to ask them, most all of them would drop this game somewhere in the top three-ish, you know?
And the only reason Matt is not in that category is because Matt has never played the game.
That's fair.
And also because almost none of those people have Matt's number one, Skyward Sword, in their top, or I guess his number two.
Yeah, so I was about to say.
So whenever we rank it, though, Lenny, can I use my second playthrough where I got to run around in my lobster outfit the entire game as part of my enjoyment?
Are you going to play through it again before we do our rank and recap?
No, but I've played it twice on my own GameCube. And so the second time I played it, I held up my invisible costume.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Do you like that lobster shirt more?
I love that lobster shirt.
That's pretty cool.
I wish that was in more Zeldas. And frankly, I'm a little upset you couldn't get that in Breath of the Wild or in Super Smash Brothers.
Actually,
I say, can't you get it in Breath of the Wild?
Via Amiibo. Yeah, you can get it in Breath of the Wild. Or if you're one of those people who has a stack of Amiibo cards that you bought from an Etsy person.
Then, like us?
Yeah.
I'm not knocking those people. I'm just not one of those people.
Okay. Well, next time you play Breath of the Wild, I'll spot you a Wind Waker amiibo, and you can get that lobster shirt to drop for you in that game, and it'll be pretty great.
Yes,
cool. All right, well, that all sounds great, Matt. I think we're good, right? You got your plot recap ready to go and everything.
I do. We're ready to go. We're ready to rock and roll as soon as I get this cigar lit.
All right. Well, with all that said, let's go ahead and get the housekeeping out of the way so that we can dive right into the meat of this episode. Talk about this section of game. It's going to be a great time. If you didn't know, Sacred Realms is a weekly reexamination of The Legend of Zelda, one little slice at a time. Sacred Realms drops every Wednesday and is available on all major podcast networks. Every week, we play a new section of a Zelda game. Then we sit down here to talk and drop our hot takes. If that sounds fun to you, please head over to Apple Podcasts, hit that subscribe button, and be sure to leave us a review. 5-star reviews are greatly appreciated, and they have a chance to get a shout out here on the show. If you want more Sacred Realms in your life, you can head over to patreon.com/sacredrealmspod to get access to our Discord channel, listener mail, vote on what game we play next, which actually is probably coming up soon.
Yeah, we should probably put that poll up this week.
Damn, it doesn't feel like it should be time again.
No, it doesn't. This game's going by fast.
Got another top down coming our way.
Yeah.
It's not going fast when you're playing with the slow sail.
Check your privilege.
Oh, man.
All those people that can afford a dang Wii U. I'm looking at you out there.
Matt and I up in our ivory towers looking down on you below. With our Wii U gamepads.
I'm on my little blue box.
I think that's the only time in popular culture that anybody has ever referred to Wii U ownership as
an ivory tower.
Ivory tower.
Oh, man. Of course.
Not a well-reviewed console. No, and I totally get why. Of course, one of the other benefits that Master Sword patrons and above get is that we read their names every week here on the show. Those legendary individuals are Fallout 907, Kelso, Tiffany the Star, Daxel, Patrice, Stephanie, Darknuck, Brian, George, Mike, Dylan, Allie, Lennon, Melanie, Kolku, Aiden, Rowan, Joshua, Nick, Keep It Going Pod, Dante, Gep, Brittany, Davey, Haru, the Mighty, Derek, Albert, Mark, Andy, Cameron, Tyler, Ben, Daniel, Nick D underscore TV, Travis, Christian, Jonathan, Hyrule Interviews, aka Maximum Nichols, Garrett, and Drew. These are the most legendary of individuals. Their patronage warms us on cold, cold nights.
Like tonight.
But without further ado, let's get into the Sacred Realms Rundown and talk about this section of the game. The Sacred Realms Rundown is, of course, a six-part analysis of what we played this week and the feelings that it made us feel. Today, we are covering the Wind Waker Chapter 6, which involves the Wind Temple. Part 1 is, as always, the plot recap. Tonight, once again read by my co-host, Matt. Matt, I pass it over to you.
As we leave the Southern Earth Temple with our good friend Medley still inside, praying for the power of the Master Sword, we set our sights towards the far northern end of the map, where the king has marked our next dungeon. As we set sail that direction, we encounter a mysterious island in our path that is wreathed in a deadly icy winds. Even approaching the shores of this forsaken island spells certain death for our companion and for ourselves. Luckily, we have the power of fire that the Fairy Queen gave us, and like we did with the volcano, we use the fire arrows this time to temporarily quell the squall of icy winds. As we make our way onto the island, slipping and sliding on the ice the whole time, we see that the inner rock of the island is in the shape of a fearsome monster with its mouth agape. So we head there and drop down the hole we find in the rocky cavern. Inside, much like in the volcano, is a small assortment of enemies that pose little threat to us as we head towards the chest at the far end of the cavern. Opening it, we find a pair of boots with the soles and toes made of pure iron. These boots weigh a proverbial ton, and we pretty quickly surmise how they can help us along our journey. The exit to the cave is blocked by a gust of wind strong enough to blow us off our feet, but with the help of the iron boots, we can make our way through the gale. Back aboard the King, we set sail once again to the north and make a couple stops at Fishmen along the way to fill in the remainder of our sea map. Once we reach the northern mountaintop that houses the Wind Temple, we hop on shore to find the entrance impassable due to a hurricane force wind that is blowing from a statue embedded in the wall. Using our handy new boots, we make our way up to the statue and smash it with the monster hammer. This opens up a gap in the rock face that we enter into to find a shrine very similar to the one in the Earth Temple, with another song engraved upon it. Conducting the melody has the same effect here as it did in the Earth Temple, and the spirit of the Wind Sage appears before us. This spirit is that of a seemingly young boy, but he quickly dispels us of that inaccurate assumption and tells us that he is the spirit of the Kokiri Wind Sage named Fado. His soul, like that of Laruto, was silenced by a monster of evil so that the Master Sword would lose its potency. Like with Laruto, we must find his descendant and bring them here to resume the task of pleading with the gods on behalf of the sword. He pulls out a violin made of the leaf of a great tree and plays the song we just learned from the shrine with us, and tells us that this instrument will be the sign of his descendant. The foliage violin and the fact that Fado tells us that the Kokiri used to be the spirits of the forest recalls to our memory strongly the Koroks of Forest Haven. So we head back south to seek out the Deku tree and see if we can find the descendant we need. As we land on the Forest Haven and we approach the Deku tree's hollow, we hear the sound of music that sounds eerily similar to the violin we heard Fado play. It seems to be coming from the waterfall, and we find a way to use the grapple hook to swing our way to a hidden cave behind the waterfall. Here we find Makar, playing the foliage violin as only his small body can, like a cello. We talk to Makar about how he is composing next year's Deku ceremony song, and we pull out the Wind Waker to conduct him, and he plays along with us as we play the Wind God's Aria. This awakens the soul of the sage within Makar, and he immediately boards the King of Red Lions with us to head to the Wind Temple. As we land back on the Wind Temple, we play the Wind God's Aria by the shrine, and just as in the Earth Temple, the shrine breaks apart once we are joined by Makar and the spirit of the sage. Our path is clear to the Wind Temple, and we follow Makar inside to face what we find there. The Wind Temple is utterly unlike the Earth Temple, except that it exudes a similar darkness of spirit that we can only attribute to the presence of the minions of evil that have perverted this once holy place into a place of malice. Makar proves moderately as useful as Medley, as he is able to plant Deku acorns in certain areas around the temple and cause the Deku sprouts to spring out of the ground in unbelievably fast time. We find a new type of obstacle as well, which requires us to stand on a switch and equip the iron boots to compress the ancient spring, and then once we unequip the boots, we are thrown skyward and able to use the Deku leaf to glide long distances. Makar is easily able to follow us by flying around, and we begin progressing through the temple. However, in short order, Makar is captured by the dark hands that plague the area while he is planting trees, and he is imprisoned behind an immense stone statue that we have no current way of moving. We continue through the temple alone, and after clearing a few rooms of puzzles and monsters, we come to a room containing a wizrobe that, instead of simply shooting fireballs, summon monsters to face us. This Wizrobe summons hordes of enemies to face us as he teleports around the room, shooting fire at us. We have to fight Darknuts, Keese, and even other Wizrobes at the same time as we fight this one. But eventually, we fell all the enemies in our way and are rewarded with a new item in the Hookshot. This useful item allows us to grab things far away from us and pull them towards us, or to even more normally, pull ourselves over long distances to a stationary object. We start immediately putting this to use and head over to the cage that holds our friend Makar, and while using the iron boots to give us some more impetus, we pull the gigantic stone edifice away from the door of the cage. With Makar free, we can keep trucking our way through the Wind Temple. And as we continue around and eventually make our way to a series of switches that lower the floor and open up the basement, where we can find the boss room. But we still need the key, so we prowl around and eventually find this coveted item, guarded by no less than 3 Darknuts, including a new variant of this enemy, plated in black armor with an ornate helm. We have a bit of a harder time with this number of simultaneous high-level enemies, but fell them in the end and claim the boss key for ourselves. We make our way through the last of the dungeon to the room that holds the boss and leave Makar in the entryway to face this menace alone. As we enter, we find a room full of falling sand with a stone pedestal in the middle. No enemy can be seen yet, but as soon as our feet hit the sand, the stone pedestal is swallowed by the sand, and an immense figure bursts forth from the sand below and starts flying around the room. This worm-like form, which we learned is named Mulgera, burrows back beneath the sand and begins pulling it towards its maw in a cascade. We have to use the hookshot to pull its glowing blue tongue towards us to deal damage to it. And once we do a round of that, it spawns some miniature worms to assault us, as the beast itself swims beneath the surface in order to assault us from below. After a few rounds of this and slaying many of the miniature worms, the beast is felled and explodes in a blaze of glory to shower us with another heart piece. Makar joins us as the pedestal bearing the sigil of the Triforce reemerges, and together with the spirit of Fado, we play the Wind God's Aria together. Makar vows to take up his station in the Wind Temple and to pray to the gods for the power of the Master Sword. And as his oath is completed, we take the Master Sword in hand and raise it to the sky in a salute. As we do so, the blade glows with a pure white light, and the jewel in the center returns to life with a brilliant golden glow, and the power that runs through the sword is such that it takes us off balance. But the Master Sword is now fully restored to its former glory, and the power to destroy evil is once again within it. With the power of the sword restored, we have what we need to go and collect the pieces of the Triforce of Courage, and then to face the evil king himself.
Well done, Matt. Beautiful.
Thank you. Fine work. Darn fine work.
Great. I appreciate it,
gents. It was a great effort. Very successful. This one, you know, a much more svelte plot recap than we really had from this game so far.
Only 4.25 pages. Really not bad compared to the 9 and the presumably 9 or 10 that yours would have been last week.
Yeah. I would love, whatever the transcription comes down from last week's, I'm very curious to see how many, like what the word count is and what the page count was on that. Because it was, woo.
I'm sure if you were to print that out and put it next to the Silmarillion, it'd be of similar length and quality.
It's roughly the length of the Lord of the Rings trilogy without the appendices.
Look, I mean, once we're done with all of our plot recaps, we'll have a miniature book on our hands. There's no doubt about that.
We'll have to bind it in some fine leather.
That would actually be kind of fun. We should definitely do that.
That'd be a good time. All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into part 2, which is our takes, where we talk about this section of the game and how it made us feel. And I just have to say up front that there was a little bit of a heart attack moment on my end of things last week, which almost led to me being worried about whether or not I was even going to be able to complete this section of the game or the game at all. And so that was a whole boondoggle that was thankfully crisis averted at the last moment. But
all right, Lyndon. Well, since you're going to tease it like that, just tell us what the boondoggle was.
Be teased. I want to know.
All right. Well, now that I've tickled everyone with my tease.
oh, no. We're a family-friendly podcast, Lyndon.
I'm sorry. I can't help it. It was just there. It was right in front of me. I had to grab it. So I...
oh, no, you're not making it better.
Don't do it.
I'm having to restrain myself so so hard.
That's
guys, we have got to stop with the dick jokes.
Okay, I'm sorry. They just keep happening. So, all right. So, a few days ago, you know, day or two before Christmas, I sat down. I was going to stay up a little later. Kiddo was down for the night. Colleen was down for the night. And I was like, all right, you know what? Christmas is coming up this weekend. It's going to be a busy one. I'm just going to knock this whole section of the game out. Should be a good time. Poured myself a glass of whiskey, fired up the Wii U, load into the game. And before I can even hit start to get in from the title screen, I get a crash screen. It's just a black screen accompanied by a noise that sounds like a cassette tape getting chewed up in a player, right? And it just, it was like so sharp in my headphones. And I was like, oh my God, did my Wii U just like have a coronary and pass right in front of me? And so on the, so the crash screen, of course, gives me a nice little, your system is experiencing memory issues, error code, whatever, refer to NintendoOfAmerica.com for details and whatnot. And so I'm freaking out because, one, this console is super old. I don't even know if you can file a support ticket on a Wii U anymore. Do a little bit of internet research, and it turns out that this is a thing that sometimes happens when a downloaded piece of software, when the memory file becomes corrupted. And the only way to fix it is to remove the game file from your system and to re-download it. And so I'm sitting over here getting pissed out of my mind because I think I'm about to have to do this whole thing.
Literally the whole game?
Yeah, like literally replay my entire game.
You even have the privilege to play this whole game.
I am blessed enough to be able to replay this classic Zelda experience. No, anyway, so it turns out that the Wii U actually has this nifty feature where your save file for a game is stored separately from the game file itself. So what you're able to do is go in and delete the game file off, and your save remains intact, and then you just re-download the game file, and everything was there again. So it was great. After that very minor heart attack, I managed to get back in and play this chunk of game for the week with only about a 30 or 45 minute setback in my schedule for the evening. So
my main takeaway from that is that you found a nifty feature in the Wii U.
And I can't imagine a situation where it's ever going to help me or anyone else ever
again.
But you're right. It was nifty indeed. Okay. So with all that being said, I did get to play it. Let's talk about how we felt about it. Mike, I'm going to let you go first. And mainly just because
it's been so long since we heard your dulcet tones.
It's been so long. And, you know, also feel free to, you know, obviously this is about a specific chunk of the game. But if you have any overarching thoughts about how the game has been feeling to you so far in your playthrough and they feel appropriate here, then go for it. This is your time.
Oh man, my time.
Oh no.
So no, it really has felt like riding a great bike. You know, you hop back on and Windfall Island, Outset Island, everything just kind of feels like a home as I'm playing through this. And yeah, there's some things that I wish I might be playing the Wii U version for, like the fast sail and things like that. And I did find some other differences to talk about as we get further into it today. But I love this game. And there are some weak points, but for the most part, I think that this is a really strong addition. And I'm having a lot of fun with the exploration, even though I've already explored it, but it's been years. And I kind of get a lot of the reason for the rails, y'all had already touched on some of it, but I'm one of those guys that when I fire up a game that's too big, I just kind of go pick a direction and go that way. And so if you had that in this game too early on, I could definitely see you getting lost and maybe never circling back around to where you need to be. I mean, the closest thing I can think of is say like Skyrim, where you're kind of funneled into the original encounter, but as soon as you've created all your stuff and get out of the dungeon and the chase from the first dragon, you're open to go wherever the heck you want.
Yes, Skyrim, a game that I have notably played many, many times.
Well, if you didn't have trash enjoyment in games, then you would have.
I brought this criticism upon myself.
You did. But no, you
because you can't say that no one's ever not tried to get you into it. Both people at this table have tried to get you into it multiple times.
And failed. my greatest failing.
People have also tried to get me into the crystal meth, and I didn't take them on that up either.
Has anyone ever actually tried to get you into the crystal meth?
No, I don't.
Okay, I was about to say, that's a story I want to hear.
I don't really scream as like being a viable target for that crowd, I don't think.
they decide that's going to be a zero sale. I like that they do kind of point you in a direction, but now that I can explore more, I'm having a lot of fun doing it. I got around to some kind of Blue Betrayal stuff we'll go over later. But as far as this section of the game, I enjoy that it is use of multiple items to get through this dungeon. It's pretty quick from the previous dungeon, Earth Temple, over here to the Wind Temple. But through this dungeon, you're using the iron boots, you're using the hammer, you're using the leaf, and you're having to use them all in some pretty, you know, ingenuitive ways to get through this dungeon. And then you get your hook shot. So, I mean, you're really needing a bunch of stuff you've accumulated at this point to get through this dungeon, which some Zelda dungeons do that. And I'm sure if I wanted to, I could rack my brain and think of a few examples. But I feel like it's fewer and far between that you get to use so many items so effectively.
Yeah. But how much time would you say that you really spent between the prior section of game going into this one? Because the thing was, when I talked to you last week, I think you had just gotten to – you were kind of approaching the Earth Temple. And you asked me how much time was going to be required to get through to your section. And I was like, dude, I'm going to level with you. I think you probably got about 10 to 11 hours of game that you need to knock out in a week.
So I essentially decided to speed run part of it. As soon as I knew kind of how much I needed to play catch up to get to this point in the podcast – I ran through a bunch, but a lot of that stuff was stuff where you were already kind of funneled anyway, and you could do side stuff if you wanted to, like the killer bees and things like that. I ran through a lot of that up front.
Yeah.
And then after I completed the Wind Temples, kind of whenever I decided, okay, you know, now I'm not on a time crunch anymore. Everything else is gravy. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of went and started doing stuff because I'm also butting up on my least favorite part of this game, which is the Triforce quest.
Sure. So I guess what this kind of brings me to is a question that's a little bit of a rabbit trail from the dungeon map, or not from the dungeon map, from our takes, and really something that probably could have been, you know, spoken about in the preamble. But I'm really curious, especially since you've played Breath of the Wild recently, you know, with us. How are you finding your enjoyment of this game's open quality? The whole structure of sailing from island to island and having this kind of larger explorable world than we're used to with a lot of these 3D titles, and having, you know, had to do quite a lot of that in the last few weeks specifically. I know you said that you kind of avoided a little bit of it this week, but I know in our memories, or at least in mine, before I sat down to replay this game, that was all very magical and it contributed very much to like the allure that the game has in my memory. Do you find that it's living up in terms of fun factor for you?
Yes. So I have a lot of nostalgia for this game, and I remember getting on the ship for the first time, King of Red Lions, and setting out sail, and you just kind of feel like you could go anywhere or do anything. And granted, some of that's tempered by the kind of rails at the beginning, but at 12, I didn't notice that one bit. I can very kind of vividly remember thinking like the world was my oyster and that I can go anywhere with this sailboat and I'm free. And that was a really cool feeling playing through it early on. A little bit of it is kind of not gone, just kind of morphed for me because I have explored this map twice before. But at this point, I've forgotten where everything is. I've forgotten the intricacies of what's on each island. But then I'll find something like, I remember you. And that's fun. And then once you kind of open things up, I love the ability to just kind of go explore. I was really spoiled by Breath of the Wild. That's my favorite kind of style, is being able to explore as I go and find new things. And it's a kind of a rehash of some of the things that I've previously explored. But I also remember I envy Matt being able to play through this for the first time and just kind of get to absorb all this and set sail.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good to hear. I'm glad that the positive memories are at least kind of like holding true for you as you sort of go through the game. Matt, I want to pass it over to you now to talk about just this specific section of the game generally. How was it feeling for you? And I guess let's go ahead and catch up too on some of your overall feelings about the game now that we're kind of getting into the home stretch. I mean, I think this marks about the three-quarter mark of the game.
Yeah. So I did a lot more side questiness today, this week as well. Not as much as last week because I wasn't making up for lost time as much. So exploration is, now that I have the fast sail, is just so much better. It's so much better. Like, I was not enjoying necessarily exploration with the slow sail. I think if I were playing the GameCube version, which you and I talked about me playing the GameCube version, and then we were like,
which now I'm glad that you didn't.
Yeah, I would not have had much. Yeah, it would have very, very harshly tempered my enjoyment of this game.
Not to interrupt you there, Matt, but you talked the other, I think it was two episodes ago, about how you would set sail to, or maybe this was Lyndon, I can't remember for sure, would set sail toward somewhere you're trying to go and have on your map. And then you would just go kind of walk away and show back up. And
yep.
Yeah.
And we're still on course and just not there yet.
I do that all the time with this game right now. It's okay. Well, I'm sailing. I guess I'm going to go get myself a whiskey and come back up. Still just cruising, Link.
Still cruising.
Okay, well, I guess I'm going to go brush my teeth. No, you're still cruising. And I feel like I've got to fill this time for the slow sail with other daily needs.
Yeah, no, it's pretty rough.
I try to think about doing this game in an era before the smartphone was a thing, and you could just get some browsing done while you're waiting to, you know, like, of course, again though, it must be reiterated that with the swift sail, that really is cut down.
Yeah, that's not really a thing.
Yeah.
And also fast travel of the Ballad of Gales. So,
well, and that is actually,
or Cyclones or whatever.
Right.
It's called.
And so even on the GameCube version, that's something that's now opened itself up to you, Mike. So
which part?
The getting the Ballad of Gales.
Yes. And so I definitely, as soon as I could, and I remembered that you needed it to kind of make that more tenable. And I went and got the Ballad of the Gales, hit my froggy boy in the sky, which, I mean, I don't know what kind of minor deity he is, but I'm surprised he doesn't have more of a following, like an island.
He's
where
a pretty cool guy.
The Froggy King.
Oh, yeah.
But I use that a lot right now to kind of get around in more broad strokes. I did remember needing to use it to get into the Great Fairy.
Okay.
I remember in my youth playing that game. That was a section that I probably woke up at one of those 4 or 5 o'clock times and spent the entire morning trying to figure out how in the ever-living bleep to get in to dang island.
He provided his own bleep. So considerate.
That one was free. The rest are on you. And so I remember that being something that I struggled with. And there were a few other areas. So it is nice having a little bit of knowledge to help speed me on my way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I, for one, found this section of the game to be,
you know, I only like got 4 sentences into how I felt about it.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and back up. I'm going to go ahead and take my foot off the pedal of the steamroller that was driving over Matt's opinions about this section of the game. Please go ahead.
We do value them.
I mean, sometimes you do. Okay. Anyway, yeah, I liked it. I think this is something that Zelda can sometimes do, and it's a thing I don't necessarily love, which is a rinse and repeat of the formula that worked for the last dungeon. Just rinse and repeat, do it again, just with a different character and a slightly different set of circumstances, right? Like, I don't want to say lazy is not the right word, but it's just like, okay, could we have done something maybe a little bit different to get Makar or I don't know. It is literally just a rinse and repeat of the last section of game from a plot perspective.
Well, and a lot of that too is just that one of the reasons that last week's section felt so much longer is because you had the whole lead up of not only the Forsaken Fortress revisit, but going through the whole scenario of having to track down
fire and ice arrows and get the power bracelets and
definitely. So all of that, it was a considerable chunk of game, right? And in addition to that, you also got your iron boots squared away last week and not this week. So
yes, I did.
So you had an even like more svelte section of game to deal with this week.
Yep. So like all of that being said, I didn't do a whole lot of open world travel. I started to, and then you and I had like a sidebar conversation in the hallway of the house of like, hey, don't do too much of your side quest stuff because we have a whole episode next week for the Triforce quest and wrapping up side quests. So like, make sure you're leaving some of that. And I was like, oh yeah, we do have that. So I'm going to stop doing the side quest things that I was about to do because I feel like I'm about to hit some of the major ones, you know, the the Deku Tree Sprouts, the Merchant Trading Quest that I started this week with the flower. And I believe that that should net me something nice. It normally does. And what else was I about to do? I was about to do some treasure hunting, but I don't know. We'll see where I land on that. Anyway, basically the only major thing I did this week, side quest wise, was just fill in the rest of my map. Because like I said, I already had the iron boots.
Well, let's save that for Bloopy Trails. Why don't we?
Yeah. so pretty svelte section, like you said, save some, more nuanced thoughts about the dungeon for dungeon map, but, retreading another, escort quest. I'm nodding my head and rolling my eyes just for those of you, since this is not a visual medium, I will let you know that that is what is on my face right now. So yeah, I mean, like, it was fine. The music continues to be standout. Just really excellent. And I know you said you wanted to catch up on my thoughts on the game in general as well. So I am definitely still enjoying the game. Like I think people have thought of me as the more critical voice of games in our podcasting duo. That's probably true, but I'm still very much enjoying the game. It's still very fun. I find myself spending a lot more time on this game voluntarily, just like, I want to go see what's over there. I want to go investigate this thing that I saw earlier, or I want to go back and see what I can find out on Windfall Island without looking up a guide, which next week I'll probably start looking up some guides on how to complete some of the more major side quests, because I don't want to just waste 10 hours doing the wrong thing. So I'm still doing all of those things completely voluntarily because I'm just enjoying it and it's fun. And the aesthetic and the vibe of the game are just hard to not enjoy because it's just so joyful and happy and fun and open. And like Mike said, exploration is something that I really genuinely enjoy from my games. That's why I love larger open world games like The Witcher and Skyrim and, you know, Mass Effect to a certain extent is a little bit different, and Breath of the Wild. Like, all of those things just come together to be a very successful formula for me, and I'm enjoying it a lot.
Well, and at this point in the game too, it must be said, we've started to really leave behind a lot of the goofiness in plot, characterization, narrative. Like, it's really kind of started to dial back a little bit in terms of those things. And
it's, you know, becoming more self-serious, which is what I was hoping for, right? And you're right, Lyndon. I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm just trying to affirm your thought.
I think that tone shift really happens after you go to lower Hyrule.
Yes.
And that really kind of, I don't know if it's like kind of a coming of age thing for this particular Link, that he's still kind of like, okay, well, this is all not super serious, even though my sister's been abducted and yeehaw. And then he goes and sees that and is like, oh, this is a big deal. I need to kind of get my stuff together and be the hero.
The stakes are way higher than originally thought. Like, originally it was just, I got to save my sister. And now it's, well, actually you kind of have to save the world, so maybe we should do that. And it definitely has taken a turn into a more serious game that I am enjoying more.
Well, and especially so in game for the characters, certainly that's true. But also the stakes have raised for you, the player, especially as somebody who has a history with the Zelda series, you know, now that, like, I know you knew the basics of the story and a lot of the surprises, right? But like, once they're kind of unraveled, like, once they're kind of unrolled for you in game, and you come to realize that your Hyrule is somewhat at stake here, I mean, that can't help but to ratchet up the tension just
a
little bit.
For sure. I think all of that is true. I don't want to, I don't know, you feel free to take this out of the episode or not, Lyndon, but it still has not surpassed Skyward Sword for me yet. Like, at this point in the game, I feel like Skyward Sword still has better dungeons overall, better art direction and aesthetic and story. I think I'm excited to, just based on the little snippet of conversation that we got from King of Red Lions after exiting the temple, which I didn't include in the plot recap this week, but will be in the plot recap next week, you know, kind of hinting that Ganon is not on the Great Sea anymore. He's kind of found our secret out, and he might be in Lower Hyrule. I don't know. He might be in Lower Hyrule. He might not be. I don't know. But like, kind of ratcheting that tension up even more. I feel like the climax of this game is going to be the make or break moment for me, where you know, it kind of either surpasses Skyward Sword or doesn't. And I think that's going to be a hard shoe to fill, because the climax of Skyward Sword is the best part of Skyward Sword. Like, it's so good.
Yeah. And so we're definitely going to have a pretty big conversation about, obviously, the dungeon of the week, but also just dungeons in this game in general once we get to part three, because, you know, in case it hadn't registered for any of y'all yet, this was
the last major dungeon.
This was the final major dungeon of the game. And I don't have a great memory of what all's involved in the final, like, going to see Ganon dungeon.
Yeah,
I don't know to what extent that is an actual dungeon or not. So that will affect things down the road. But yeah, we'll have a larger conversation about dungeons for sure. Before we get to there, let's talk a little bit about narrative, plot, characters. Yep. So like you were saying, much like last week, we're repeating the same basic story structure, in which we have got to go find a character that we've met earlier in the game and team up with them to get some stuff done here. Last week was Medley, and this week is Makar. And I don't know about y'all. I'm going to pass it to Mike after a brief thought on this, but I'm just going to say that I prefer the company of Medley as a character. I enjoy her personality more, and that's not even talking about the mechanics of the dungeon or anything, but I enjoy her more as a character. And I'm wondering how much that has to do with the fact that Medley is much more like, she's much more easily able to be anthropomorphized, you know,
yeah,
because of like more identifiably human features and whatnot. Like Makar is kind of cute and quirky in his way.
I want to put him in a satchel and carry him around.
Yeah, he's kind of got a Grogu thing going on.
Yes.
You know?
Yep.
he's a little leafy Grogu. But you know, that's not quite enough to make me enjoy him as a character more than I did Medley. Mike, where are you kind of at with this?
No, I agree. It was cool seeing Korok, you know, and being like, oh, I've seen you before. And I had seen him before Breath of the Wild. So having that kind of come back was cool. And I love his cello fiddle. It's probably one of my favorite instruments that gets played in the game.
I agree. It also has an amazing, the sound bites that they use for the cello violin thing are gorgeous. They're phenomenal. Oh my gosh. Yeah, they're so
amazing.
Good.
And that's one of his redeeming factors for me, is just that's his chosen instrument. And I love all the stuff to do with the Deku Tree throughout all the Zeldas. I think that's some of the cooler stuff for me. So I really enjoy just his, I guess, species and then characterization. I don't have a whole lot of like specific love for Makar, but I don't dislike him either. He's just kind of there for me.
Yeah, I would say that's kind of how I feel about him also, is he's cute. It makes a lot more sense that we can carry him around over our head for an entire dungeon than necessarily carrying Medley around. Although since she's a bird person, I assume she has hollow bones, so maybe she's lighter than she looks, but still, less mass there.
How long did it take y'all to figure out how to get behind the waterfall to meet Makar?
I had to Google it. I couldn't figure it out.
So I can't say whether it was just me being on my big detective brain or whether it's a past experience, but I remembered how to get in to go meet Makar, and so it didn't take me very long to get to him.
It's a cool little gameplay moment in and of itself, where you have to use – so you can see the musical notes from Makar's fiddle coming out from behind a waterfall. He's clearly back there. And the solution is that you have to use the grapple to – so there's like a little grapple point that was previously used to get up the moving river to get into the Forest Haven. And it's pretty high up there, which is, I think, why I didn't immediately think to try it, you know?
That's exactly why I didn't either.
But what you have to do is you have to grapple onto that, and then you can swing behind, like, if you swing into the waterfall, then it kind of shoops you into Makar's little hidey hole. Yep. And it's a neat little gameplay moment that made me really wish that we had done more going behind waterfalls to find things elsewhere in the game.
Going behind waterfalls is a classic Zelda moment. There's treasure behind waterfalls. Go behind all the waterfalls.
I mean, that is a trope if there ever was one. If there's any video game I'm playing and there's a waterfall that's even remotely accessible to me, I'm going to check behind it.
Yes, every time.
And if there's not something behind it, I'm upset.
Yes.
But especially in this game, right? Where I feel like we could have had, you know, waterfall cave treasure on lots of these islands that we've been to, and it could have been really neat.
Yeah.
We could have had Zora too, but, that didn't happen.
Yeah, I was about to say. And
Laruto is crying right now, Mike.
Well, you know,
She's a spirit, so Mike's still technically right. She's not Azora anymore. She's a ghost of Azora.
True. My headcanon is that the Azora all are down there somewhere beneath the surface, like silly humans or up there on those hills. Yeah, it's our maybe. Water world now.
Yeah, that's true. They do have the whole kingdom of Hyrule to themselves.
Yeah. So we team up with Makar, and that basically comprises most of the preamble in this section.
Yes. So to just backtrack on the waterfall just for a minute, I was like going so – I made it way more complicated for myself than I probably needed to. I like went into the Deku tree thing and was trying to find a hole to fall down into. Since I already had the iron boots, I like tried to use the iron boots to jump into the river right above the waterfall.
And that's what I did as well.
And I like, you know, you do the thing and, you know, drown or whatever, and then wake up on the dry land. And I was like wandering around for a while and was finally like, screw it. So I Googled it. IGN helped me out. Thank you, IGN. And his little cave is cool, though. And like, I liked the whole thing that he had going on there. This is where I come to compose new music.
If I was Makar, I would be chilling in this cave quite often.
Absolutely.
I bet the acoustics are dope.
Oh, they're probably great. Except for the roaring of the waterfall, I feel like would probably not be the best accompaniment to your music, especially if you're playing a string instrument. But
does he have ears?
I'm going to have to assume that he does, because he's pretty talented at composing music.
Well, like, what if he's pulling a, is it Bach? Bach or Mozart who had the...
No, he was blind.
Someone had difficulty with a...
Beethoven.
Beethoven went almost deaf. Wow. Went deaf in his later years. That's
like
right.
A bad music guy. But yes, so maybe he's just feeling the vibrations.
He's like Worf from Star Trek.
He's just playing it at maximum volume.
You never see his ears, but you know they've got to be behind the hair somewhere.
They're somewhere in there.
No, yeah, no idea on Makar's ears. But yeah, I mean, yes, his little hidey hole is pretty cool. But once we pick up Makar and head back to... what's the name of the island where this it's not Headstone Islands where the Earth Temple is. I forget the name of the Wind Temple one. It doesn't really matter. But once we pick up Makar and head back that way, that's really everything that there is to get up to in this section of game prior to the dungeon, excluding Bloopy Trail stuff. So with that in mind, unless anybody has anything else that they want to say generally about this section, I move that we move on to the dungeon map, because I've got a lot of thoughts about this dungeon specifically, but also about dungeons generally in this game.
Gale Isle. It's called Gale Isle.
Gale Isle. Cool.
And I second the motion.
And I third the motion. Therefore, the motion passes.
The motion passes. Let's move on to part three, which is the dungeon map, where we analyze this week's dungeon from mechanics to music and more. Dungeon this week is the Wind Temple. And as Matt mentioned earlier, the entire thing is basically an escort dungeon with Makar taking the place of Medley. And I just want to say that while I have never had a bad time playing a dungeon in a Zelda game, I don't think, and I did not have a bad time playing this one, I think that it is the low. I think that it is the low point of dungeons in this game so far.
I would agree with that sentiment.
At this point, I concur, and I think that things go up from here in my recollection. But it definitely was not my favorite dungeon. A lot of it felt like things that I've seen or felt in other Zelda dungeons, just kind of put here. There was nothing exceptional as far as like new mechanics. I will say I enjoyed the iron boots, springies.
Yeah, those are fun.
And a couple things. I have thoughts on the iron boots. Let me know when I should voice them. But
well, actually, go ahead and do that now, since they're not technically a dungeon item.
Okay, so iron boots. First thing, cool item. Wouldn't you weigh the same whether they're equipped on your person or in your backpack?
I had the exact same thought. Physics, guys.
So you're wearing these boots. The spring goes down. All of a sudden, you just put them in your backpack. Whoop! I'm up in the sky. And then they don't weigh you down anymore? Like,
yeah.
Well,
explain.
I mean, I have no explanations for you. I think now we're back to the Link's magical backpack theory of Zelda item.
Bag of holding.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's no encumbrance if it's in the bag.
It's like Hermione's bejeweled handbag that she can carry around with a whole tent and a whole library in there. And she's just like literally just pinky holding it sometimes. So I guess it's like that.
That's the only way this frail boy could do what he does. So, I mean, I thought that was interesting. Maybe just a weird thought in my head about his iron boots. But I love the use of them, not only to get up to the the statue with the wind and using that effectively.
I just want to know, iron boots being a recurring item in Zelda games, who are these made for? Like,
yeah, it's very weird. This is such a niche item in Ocarina of Time and really in Twilight Princess as well. You have to have the Zora tunic in order to breathe underwater. Otherwise, they just like make you walk real slow. And I guess in Twilight Princess, you can wrestle Gorons with them. But like, yeah, what? What?
So correct me if I'm wrong. Is Ocarina of Time the first time you see iron boots?
Yes.
So my thoughts on it, and Max Nichols might know more, or really anyone with more Zelda knowledge than I do, which is a lot of people. Maybe they were trying to make use of more space, because it doesn't make sense that Link could walk on the floor of the water.
Oh, sure. And let me reiterate, from a gameplay perspective, especially in Ocarina of Time, where traversing a water temple, the water temple, is a whole mechanic, and the whole weighted situation of like being able to freely explore the floor of a flooded area, totally get it from that perspective. I'm just wondering, fictionally, who sat down and said, all right, I'm gonna make two awesome pairs of boots. One, he's like, hey, get this, guys, get this. One is gonna be made of gold, and you can hover above gaps with them. You can literally walk on the air. And everyone's like,
that's pretty awesome. Like, let's do that. That's so cool, man.
Great. He's like, oh, okay, so that sounds great. What's the other one? He's like, okay, get this, even better. They're so heavy that you can't hardly move.
And everyone's like, what? And he's like, yeah, but if you were to like drop something on your toe, it wouldn't hurt.
Yes.
I guess that's cool.
So if you want to go work the oil fields, you got them. No, what I think it was is probably they're sitting around their little, their think tank, and they're like, okay, well, we got to make Link walk on the floor. How are we doing this in a water temple? And someone's like, oh, I don't know, scuba diving weight belt? And they're like, no, too mainstream, iron boots.
But I mean, yeah, definitely. But that kind of brings up a point, though, which is that in this game, they're neat looking for sure. And they do allow you access to the temple itself, which is useful. But past that, really their main function is to be
puzzle solving.
Yeah, to activate the little springy platforms, right? We don't have an underwater section in this game, so they're not used for that same purpose. So where I kind of come away from this discussion is, I don't know if the iron boots did anything in this dungeon that could not have been accomplished with the Deku Baba pods from earlier in the game.
Totally agree. It's kind of an interesting, it's just an interesting item. And I think the iron boots kind of have this same thing in Ocarina of Time as well. You use them in the one dungeon and then like never again. Like they have no use outside of the very specific place in which you're supposed to use them. In Twilight Princess, like I said, you at least get to use them to wrestle Gorons or something. And also they have the magnetic property, which is neat. Yeah. But like, I don't know, they're just one of those items that are in a lot of 3D Zelda games that you use in the dungeon and then never again, and they just sit in your backpack.
I'm sorry, go ahead. But if iron boots are your favorite item, please get on the Discord or send something to Lyndon and Matt, and please let them know why iron boots are your favorite.
I don't know if I would believe that person if they did that.
It's cool. a troll account.
I'll take audience engagement wherever I can get it. So yeah, go for it. But you know, and all of this is fine. It's very minor gripe because again, the iron boots are not the main item of the dungeon. Like, if that was the main thing you got from this, then I think I'd be more disappointed. The main item is much cooler.
Well, you know what is also interesting, and I'm cutting you off mid thought because I just had a thought, and it is in both Ocarina of Time and Wind Waker, you get the iron boots in the ice cavern, basically.
Right.
Which I think is kind of interesting. I like that. That's a neat parallel.
It is. Yeah. There you go. You found it, Matt.
Hooray. Parallels.
You
Woo!
Got it in one. Okay. So talking about puzzle solving in this dungeon, going back to Makar, escort mechanics the whole way through. Makar has a much different set of abilities than Medley did, but also kind of doesn't, because a lot of his control sections are based around the power of flight, right?
Yep, just like Medley's.
But he's got a secondary mechanic, which is much different, where he's got he's got the ability to drop seeds in these little seed mounds and they pop trees up, right? Which is inherently much less cool than Medley's thing of being able to, like, while you're holding her, when you jump, she can fly you places.
Yeah. Or her mirror shield harp thing that is a cool puzzle solving mechanic that you have to do in tandem. Yeah, there's no in tandem puzzle solving with Makar. It is fly Makar over here, plant some acorns, use Link to hookshot your way across, and then pick Makar up and go through the door.
And it's way less environmentally cool because a lot of those tree planting puzzles, later in the dungeon, they kind of serve to help you with traversal. But early in the dungeon, it's much more like, oh, plant two trees and then a chest appears or something.
And you get a treasure chest or a rupee. Yeah. And you're like, sweet.
It opens a door and I'm over here like, I guess.
Yeah, sure. That somehow works.
This is just all a plan by Big Arbor Day to come get us to plant trees.
Big Lumber is insinuating themselves into Zelda.
I mean, controlling Makar himself is still fun. And I like his little helicopter mechanic that he's got. He does have much more range of movement in the air than Medley did.
So I actually had a weird circumstance where if you're not tapping A for Makar to keep the helicopter thing going, if you just like let him glide for too long, he just drops like a stone and you can't start it back up in midair.
Yeah, I think that's intentional.
Yeah, it also annoys me because I was like trying to just glide him over and conserve his airtime, and then he just dropped like a stone to the bottom of the thing. And I was like, look, buddy, I really need you to help me out here, and you're not doing it. So that was a slight frustration.
Can't even hear your anger because he doesn't have ears.
Maybe he can sense the vibrations of my tone of voice. I don't know.
Yeah. So one thing that I want to mention about this dungeon, and I'm going to pass it to Mike for a response on this one. This is kind of a piece of feedback I had with last week's a little bit too, but not nearly as much, where the theming of the dungeon doesn't really seem to be borne out in the aesthetic or the puzzles that are taking place within it. So we're calling this the Wind Temple, right? And it does have a few wind-based puzzles, but for the most part, it really feels much more foresty dungeon part two, you know?
No, for sure. And even in my head, I thought there would be more to do with the wind. And yes, you get to use the Deku Leaf and kind of fly around on some of that. But I really don't think that Wind Temple was necessarily the best title for this temple. Or if they were going to call it that, maybe throw in a little bit more as far as mechanics involving wind.
Yeah, because you know you've got a few gusts that you have to traverse in the first few rooms, and then once you get into the back half of the dungeon, there is what looks like it's supposed to be the dungeon's main room, right? It's a 3 or 4 stories high tube
wind turbine.
Yeah, that's got a propeller at the bottom, and once you walk in there, it really looks like the way that this should work is the same as like Snowpeak Temple. Snowhead is Majora's Mask.
Yes.
Yeah. Where it's got that like that whole main middle room that you have to constantly find ways to like
get to the correct level.
Yeah, ascend to new levels. And I was very excited for that when I saw that was kind of the setup of that room. I enjoy that sort of thing immensely. And I was a little disappointed because it basically doesn't end up being that at all.
I thought the same thing, especially with the fact that there were 4 windmill-type apparatuses at the top of the temple. And I thought we were going to have to figure out how to like activate those and kind of maneuver them around to access like airways to other sections. And like you said, you literally just – once you activate the giant turbine at the bottom, you go up to the top and that's where you get the boss key. And like that's it. That's all there is to it. And I was just like, man – okay, like, I guess. And then most of the puzzles are Iron Boot related, block movement, or hookshot traversal. Mm-hmm. Like, that's really all there is to it. And, it was, like, kind of disappointing that they didn't utilize the great wind mechanics that they have because, like, there are some mini games out on the world, like the wind gliding with the Deku Leaf that you can do by Dragon Roost Island where you have to hit the updrafts and glide a long distance and, like, even utilizing the wind direction to get into Forest Haven Temple or the Dark Forest or whatever it's called. Like that was more involved wind mechanics than you had in this dungeon.
Well, and to Mike's earlier point, we have got enough items in our arsenal at this point that could be used in the solving of aerial wind-based puzzles, right?
For sure.
Between the Deku Leaf, between the grapple, you know, between the abilities that Makar has, you know, mm-hmm. and then adding the hookshot and, I guess, springy Iron Boot platforms on top of that, I really just feel like we should have spent a lot more of this dungeon traversing the 3D aerial space the same way that we did with Light in the Earth Temple, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it really just kind of boiled more down to block moving and hookshot stuff, like you were saying, Matt.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So one thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, that I noticed on the section is whenever y'all are using the Deku Leaf, does it give you an indicator on the ground of where you would land?
On the HD version, it does.
Yes.
So it is not for me. Which created a little bit of trial and error on trying to figure out how to land on some of these little platforms. And I did get kind of frustrated with that and looked it up and saw that was one of the glow-ups that you fancy Wii U boys are getting.
How many times did you fall all the way down that giant shaft just because you missed the...
I fell down some shaft more than a couple times.
Yeah, that's definitely one of those like user experience things that I think is, you know, it's hard for me to imagine it being much fun without that. I'm sure at a certain point you just learn to judge it a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, as I went, I got better and better. And I wouldn't say that it was a huge thing for very long. I definitely had a few errors in landing judgment, and then after that, it kind of course corrected itself just by. Me getting acclimated to it. Do you know you also can't aim bombs the same way in the GameCube version?
I did not. How does it work in the GameCube?
So you guys get a little indicator of where your bomb's going to go, correct?
Yeah, it's a little dotted line thing.
I don't get... I just point bomb and shoot and hope it ends.
Well, and that's actually interesting. I hadn't considered that before. As far as I... Does Skyward Sword have a little... indicator like that with bomb throwing?
Definitely. Yeah, and bomb rolling.
I can't remember. Yeah, that's right. I can't remember if Twilight Princess does or not. To me, this is something that, well, I don't know. I'm over here saying I think every 3D Zelda game should have this, but Breath of the Wild doesn't have it.
I was about to say Breath of the Wild doesn't have it. So. But Breath of the Wild is also much more predictable, I think. Like, for some reason, I have a harder time judging the distance of travel with in Wind Waker. I don't know why that is, but, like, even with arrows and with bombs.
I think it's probably the flatness of the geometry from a color standpoint.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. So that makes it more difficult with the bombs too, and it doesn't really hit me too much unless I'm out there trying to pirate it up and blow things up. And I definitely have a couple more splooshes than kabooms.
You never want more splooshes than kabooms.
Luckily, you have 100 bombs in your arsenal to make up for that, so you can kind of depth charge your way to it. So.
Yeah. So I guess let's go around the table real quick. Let's everyone kind of pick out a puzzle that you think is maybe a good one to talk about.
Yeah,
that happens here because I've and it may actually all be the same one, because I think there's one specific one that I can see being a big frustration point for a lot of people.
I would say I didn't have too many frustrating puzzles. I thought one that I actually kind of like that I think most people find kind of annoying is move the blocks in front of the moving guillotines. I like that one because I get such petty vindication from just pushing the block all the way over to the side so that the guillotine can't move at all. And I just sit there and watch it and I say, screw you, you stupid guillotine.
I think we're talking about the same one. Is this the one right before you get to the boss room?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. That one gives me petty revenge satisfaction, which I like.
I mean, I also thought that one was one of the more fun, and I did a very similar like, I'll defeat you, Temple. You just watch me. But there was nothing else that I really can hit on that was a specific hindrance to me. I really did like, despite the physics issues of the iron boots, the springiness and then getting to use that to traverse. It felt, I mean, yes, I know we do a very similar thing with the Deku Babas, but I just kind of liked this addition.
It was a little more, there's a word I'm looking for that I lost. I had it at the tip and I lost it. Anyway, I agree. I like it a little bit more than the Deku Baba. I actually think my favorite room in the dungeon was probably the mini boss before you get the hookshot, where you're fighting the Wizrobe that's spawning the enemies infinitely. I liked that room a lot. I thought that was one of the more fun enemy encounters, if not the most fun enemy encounter outside of a main boss that we've had in the whole game so far.
He was very fun. And I remember because in the GameCube version too, I don't believe it shows any hint of who these enemies' names are.
It doesn't.
And so I did not know this growing up. And I also, at 12, didn't have real access to the internet. So I just kind of made up names for folks. I want to say this kid's name was Josh. We played on the playground together, and he knew more than I did. So I would go to him if I had. I think he might have actually been one of the ones that told me how to get into the Great Fairy Island.
Yeah.
So you know, back before I had chat rooms and such, it was, "Hey Josh, what's next?" And but I remember at one point he told me that those were called Wizrobes, and I called this one the Arch Wizrobe.
Ooh, I like that. He's infinite summoning power of evil critters is definitely a pretty cool magical ability to have if you're like a ne'er-do-well in the Zelda universe.
Yeah, I thought that fight was so fun. It was like hectic and difficult, and like you had to move, you had to use the whole space, and you had to like, you had to balance between clearing out the mob that was being summoned versus trying to damage the Arch Wizrobe, which we're going to use that from now on. And yeah, I just really liked that mini boss fight. It was so fun.
I loved this room as well. And I think really what it serves to do is to be a thesis statement within this game for how good the base combat is and how
agreed.
It feels.
Yeah, totally agreed.
I do love the combat in this game. And I know you guys have already touched on it probably once an episode of how kind of great and fluid the combat is. There are few Zelda games after this game where I thought the combat was as fluid and made me feel as powerful as this combat does. The spin behind people, you know, cut their back and all that just feels so good that I remember after a certain point, I just didn't have difficulty with much of the combat anymore unless they threw you a bunch of enemies.
Like this.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No. I think it's an overall great boss fight. And, you know, I think that a lot of times in dungeons, the designers feel that a mini boss fight has got to be a bespoke enemy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like it's something unique to the dungeon and to that area. And sometimes that really works and sometimes it doesn't. I thought that Mothula, you know, was a good example of a time that it works early in the game. But I really appreciate sometimes just having a space like this where it's like, look, we don't need to create a new enemy to put you up against here. We're just going to drown you in like enemies that you've already fought.
Here's two dark nuts, a flock of keys, a moblin and another wizrobe all at the same time. And they're all chucking crap at you to try to kill you. And now you also have to damage the arch wizrobe.
Well, that's a Breath of the Wild ass feeling situation.
Yeah, it is. It's awesome. It was so cool.
Yeah. So definitely liked the mini boss fight a lot. Of course, you mentioned clearing this room does award you with the hookshot, and I've got to say, the art, like the design of this hookshot,
is so cool.
It's got to be the coolest hookshot in the series.
Sure, it's also the least useful because its range is like 10 feet. Like that's my primary thing against it is like it has such short range.
So I do think they kind of nerfed this version, but also you get the grappling hook, which I think that they didn't want to make this completely outdo the grappling hook. So they kind of had to give it some limitations. I think it's a great rendition of the hook shot, but I like that you have to use it in conjunction with the grapple still from this point forward.
Yeah. Yep. It's a kind of a shame because I think a lot of the puzzle solving you do with the hook shot in this dungeon is pretty elementary. Like if you've used a hook shot in a 3D Zelda game before, then none of the puzzles that really utilize it are too much of a head scratcher for you, with the exception of the one that gets Makar out of his prison.
Yeah, that one was weird. I kind of had a hard time with that one.
So that's where you have to use the iron boots in conjunction, correct?
Yeah, yeah. And I was trying to get behind the statue to like push it out of the way. I was trying to use the iron boots to give myself some more impetus to move it. I was trying to do all sorts of things before we got the hookshot. Then I got the hookshot and was trying to figure out how to, again, use the hookshot to get behind it. And then like eventually I was like, oh, it's got the little ring circle on it. I wonder if I can hookshot that, even though it's pure stone, which doesn't make any sense that you can hookshot that.
Could
but
be a porous stone?
I mean, I guess so.
It's
but
a nice volcanic pumice.
So yeah, like, I don't know. I thought that the solution to that puzzle was a little obtuse.
Hey. One for the jar. Look, I think that it's a cool puzzle in a vacuum. Right.
Yeah.
Like on paper, yeah. It's fun. It's nice having to use two items in conjunction like that.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
Again, I wish that there was some education around this or some like some more use past this.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen having to use the iron boots with the hook shot for other things. And it could have been a cool combat mechanic. So
yeah.
If you had heavy enemies
mm-hmm.
and, you know, like maybe a heavy enemy that you get around behind them to use your sword swipe and there's no straps or anything. And you're like, oh, shoot. You know, what am I doing here? And then you find out, well, hey, I can use my iron boots and my hookshot to pull off their heavy helmet or pull something out of their hand. That could have been cool.
Yeah, it would have been very much like the fire temple fight in Twilight Princess, where you have to use the magnetic iron boots to pull the chains on the big fire.
Fyrus.
Yeah, I kept trying to remember his name. Thank you. I think that is one of the coolest mechanics in Twilight Princess, and is a fun mechanic that I like a lot. And it utilizes those items very well.
Just imagine a dark nut, like the mother of all dark nuts, right?
Yeah, where you have
huge, big design coming at you with this massive slab of a sword, and the design of the sword has got like a little target looking thing on it. So after trying to fight this thing unsuccessfully for a while, you realize that that's a hookshot target, which you can use to pull the sword away from the dark nut. And at that point, you're just kind of walloping on it like Kalaktos in Skyward Sword.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that would have been so cool. And the fact that they set that something like that up with this little puzzle and then didn't capitalize on it is kind of disappointing, because that would have been so fun and it would have been really cool, and they didn't do it. So, Lyndon, what I'm taking out of this is we should submit some ideas for the next Zelda game and some
I was going to say, I hope that somewhere someone from Nintendo actually listens to the podcast and is like, oh man, I'm going to write this one down.
This is assuming that we ever get a hookshot in a Zelda game again.
Which that's not likely.
We will. I feel it in my bones.
Okay. I hope you're right.
We'll take that to the bank, Mike. If it doesn't happen, I'm going to feel very disappointed in you specifically.
I'm used to it.
I love you. No. So yeah, definitely a little bit of a missed opportunity there. Look, I think this really all just goes back again to what I've been saying, which is that at no point does the difficulty of this dungeon feel like it hits a satisfying ramp.
Yeah, it's just not a hard dungeon. I would say that most of the puzzles are not challenging nor enjoyable. And while the escort mission aspect from last week was good because it was also a puzzle solving mechanic, that is almost the opposite of the case this time around, and kind of detracts from the dungeon overall. So yeah, I have to say that this is probably my least favorite dungeon in this game, if not in any 3D Zelda game.
Now I think the big bright spot of this dungeon, and one place where I think it's a clear winner over the Earth Temple, is in the boss encounter, which is, of course, one of the most famous Zelda boss fights of all time, which is Mulgera, which I actually think is a very fun fight. I like the scale of that arena. You know, I think there's just enough going on with it where having to dodge the individual little baby Mulgeras while trying to target the eye with the hookshot. You know, that's fun. I don't want to say that this is the hardest boss fight of all time, but I think that it is a really fun one. And it must be said, and I kind of alluded to this last week as well, but the soundtrack while you're fighting this boss is just so stinking good. I love the Mulgera theme so much, and I think that there's a really good reason that it appears frequently in like when you listen to the Symphony of the Goddesses, right? And if they have like a boss battle medley, mm-hmm. it's always in there, and mm-hmm. I think that's for a really good reason.
Mm-hmm. I can tell Matt's chomping at the bit to say something, so I want to hear it.
I did not think this boss fight was that great. I thought that the high point of the boss fight was the spawning of the mini Mulgeras that attack you. But the fact that Mulgera's damage phase consists of him sitting in the middle of a ring, completely stationary, you using a hook shot on a giant blue glowy target that doesn't move, pulling it to you. And you can do all of this with Z targeting. You don't even have to manual aim. It's use Z target, hook shot, slap. I just thought it was like, eh. Fine. And I thought that it was less interesting than the boss fight in Ocarina of Time, because in Ocarina of Time, that boss is moving all around. Z targeting doesn't work on it at a certain point in the fight, and there's a lot more opportunities to take a lot of damage against Morpha. Because you're kind of playing the floor as lava. You don't have that here. It was... it was kind of middle of the road for me, to be honest.
So I'm actually going to fall in Matt's corner on this particular boss fight. I love the aesthetic of Mulgera.
Yes.
Let's just go with it. It's a creature. So the creature,
it's a creature.
It's a creature. So this creature spawns a bunch of little baby creatures. And I think that if they would have taken away, and we've said, I think you said this last episode, Matt, if they would take away Z targeting for some of these boss fights, I think they'd be a lot more interesting.
Yeah.
And how big do we think Mulgera's brain is? Cause I'm thinking maybe small. It comes out, looks super rad. You're like a Steve Irwin killing, I mean, just giant, you know, manta ray looking sky thing. But then you come dive into the sand and just put your tongue out. Like, I'm just gonna, you know, just tickle the air a little bit.
Yeah.
And
what? Yeah,
so you can fly. Just stay in the freaking air, you freaking animal. And then you can either dive bomb or just shoot your little babies down at Link. Like, what are you doing in the ground?
Do you kind of get, Matt, why I was confused a few weeks back about which dungeon Mulgera was the boss?
Yes, this makes very little sense that this is the Wind Temple boss. Like, what? It's in the sand.
It can fly. So
I guess that's fair.
If it flew more, cool. Or if, you know, if there were some like wind tornadoes, let's call them haboobs, where it like blows the sand around and, you know, made it like zero visibility, or it like lifts you up with these things that, you know, like lift you toward the boss's maw or something.
Mm.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
But you just dive in the sand, you swim around a little bit. I cut your babies. I mean, it really didn't like draw me in a whole lot, beside that I loved
the aesthetic.
Mulgera visually.
Yeah.
And the
yeah.
sound is great.
Yeah. Well, while we're talking about things in this dungeon that, like, what would we have done to make this better, right? Imagine a version of this boss fight where you've got platforms around the edges of the arena that you've got a hook shot up to gain some altitude or something. Like, and we've done that already is the thing. We did that with Goma.
Man, I'm thinking, like, just spitballing of if the final two damage phases where you had to get elevation, hookshot onto Mulgera's back, and then hit its weak spot from while you're like riding it. Dude, that would be so cool and so much better. And then like use the iron boots to get it back down towards the ground. Oh, like
you jump on this guy with your iron boots and squish him.
Yes, oh, man. Give me something like that instead of just creature in sand, mini sand cyclone, and bleh, tongue. Like, come on.
That's a pretty impressive tongue.
Thank you.
It is. It really is. It's got some girth, it must be said. So I've talked
about Mulgera's, not mine. Just to make sure that everyone's on the same page, they're not talking about my tongue. It's Mulgera's tongue.
I was hoping for a little bit of confusion
on that. Yeah, way to clear that up and keep people guessing, Matt. Or not keep people guessing, I should say. Okay, so look, I've talked about the soundtrack, and Matt, I think I've hyped this up a lot for you. I've said that this is probably my favorite boss soundtrack in the series. And I'm curious to know whether you agree with me or not.
I think it's the most unique. I think that it is recognizable. It is unique. It is interesting. I think it lacks a darker undertone. It's all wood flute or pan flute, and it's very bright. It's very like foresty, but like happy foresty. So I think it's missing an element of danger that boss fights, in my opinion, should have. And you showed me like a cover or a redo that literally they did just the pan flute melody, but then underlaid it with some like darker chanting kind of. And that like took it to a whole other level of awesomeness. And I think without that darker undertone, it doesn't communicate the sense of danger or urgency that boss fights should, in my opinion.
Yeah, so I love when boss fight music changes with different either damage phases
or
aspects of it.
Yep.
So what I would have liked, I mean, I still love the music, and I think that Wind Waker is a big high for music in general.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have loved to have seen, especially with this boss fight, maybe as it's up in the air, get like a drum solo or something.
Yeah,
like
just add some percussion.
Some sets of urgency of it. Oh, yeah. No, this is above me now. Yeah. That's not great.
Just give me some low rolling timpani. Yeah, I don't know. That's where I'm at with it.
Those are fair criticism. My opinion might be slightly colored by the infinite number of really cool versions of this song that have been done in like Smash Bros. And orchestrations and all kinds of stuff. Yeah. You know?
Oh, for sure. Like the Symphony of the Goddess version of this in the boss fight medley is infinitely better. Like, it's, and it's awesome. It's so good.
And yeah. It's difficult for that to be too much of a criticism, given that, as I mentioned to you earlier, Matt, you got to remember that this game exists in a world before
orchestrated. Yeah. No, it's totally fair. That's a totally fair point to make.
Does anybody have anything else they want to say about the temple specifically before I drop an overall thought about Wind Waker Dungeons and then move out of this section?
No, drop your thought. I want a bloop.
I want to know the thought.
So here's my thing. I think we're all unanimous in saying that this dungeon was overall a disappointing experience. And the thing about Wind Waker is that it is a game with not a lot of dungeons. And yep. even when you remove the background knowledge that we have, which is that dungeons were cut from this game in development, it's still a small amount of dungeons, especially compared to Ocarina of Time or which Twilight Princess or Skyward Sword or whatever. There's just not that many. So if you're not going to have too many dungeons and you're going to make up for the smaller amount with a game that is overall really fun to play and augmented by like great exploration and whatever, then that's great. I think that that's a judgment call that you can make. And I think that that game could still be a huge success.
Key point in that favor is Majora's Mask, 4 dungeons, all of them superb.
Yeah. And that's the thing. If you're going to do it that way, then you can't miss with any of your dungeons.
Correct.
And this one I feel like is a miss, and it's even more disappointing given that it's really the final one.
Yep, I agree. So my view, knowing that this is really our last mainline dungeon, is that I think there are some really good dungeons here. I think there are good dungeons. Overall, I'd score Wind Waker dungeons overall like a 7 out of 10, like as a whole, which is great. It was a good score. It's a really good score. But just against games like Ocarina of Time or Majora's Mask or Skyward Sword, it does not rise above any of those three games in particular in overall quality of dungeons, in my opinion.
I agree. There are a couple dungeons I enjoy. I enjoy the one, on names because I'm terrible with names, but the one where you fight like all the guardians and then get the Master Sword.
The Tower of the Gods.
Yeah, I love Tower of the Gods. I think that one's fantastic.
Awesome.
I actually really like the first one too with Valu.
Dragon Roost Island.
And I thought Dragon Roost Island was fantastic.
Yep.
Playing it again too, I also really enjoyed it this third time around. It's really just these last two dungeons that I don't think are necessarily like the pinnacle.
So you did not enjoy the Earth Temple much.
I thought it was okay, but it was kind of a... If I were to graph the dungeons, Lyndon, I would say that it kind of starts on a decently high point, kind of goes up, peaks, and then these two are kind of a downhill for me.
I'm sorry, finish that.
I think that the reason that some people don't remember Wind Waker Dungeons very favorably are from here, you really kind of go to the end game. And I think that maybe leaving the dungeons on a kind of either like a more meh or like... not that sour. Yeah, I still enjoyed the dungeon, but I kind of autopiloted through it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think leaving it on kind of a less than spectacular dungeon set, you kind of have that taste in your mouth, you know?
Yeah. I would say that I would score this particular dungeon like a 4 out of 10. Like, I would say that this is not a great dungeon. And so I can definitely see how that would leave people with a little bit of a different and not great overarching feeling about dungeons, and in particular seeing as this is the last one. I think to what you were saying, Mike, Dragon Roost Island starts off at such a high point. I think Forest Haven Temple was kind of also meh. Tower of the Gods was great. And then I really liked the Earth Temple, just the complexity of the puzzles and the utilizing of your companion to solve some really complex light-based puzzles was excellent. So like, I thought that one was probably the second highest point in the game for me.
Right. I'd say 7 out of 10 for Earth Temple. And then you kind of go into this. I think if it had been one companion quest, one time kind of doing this mechanic, it would have been a more favorable outlook for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't dislike any temple in this. I just kind of find myself hoping for more in some of them than others. But I will say, without ruining anything, like going in toward the end game, it's one of my favorite end game slash kind of going toward the finales of any, after you get through the Triforce quest, which I'm going to complain about until the end of time. then it goes up from there.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah. All right. Well, with all that said, let's move on to part four, which is Bloopy Trails, where we talk about interesting things that diverted our attention this week. Mike, I'm gonna let you go first.
So I did a whole lot of piracy. I found myself short on rupees. Because I did start the Triforce quest, and I'm not going to talk too much about it because I don't want to ruin next week's episode.
Well, and as mentioned by Josh last week, technically they were kind of wanting you to be chipping away at the Triforce quest a little bit ever since you leave the Tower of the Gods. So it was not inappropriate for you to be doing that.
Yeah, so I'm chipping. I'm chipping away, and it takes way too long to chip at anything with that dang quest. But you find yourself short on rupees, especially on the GameCube version. And so I was going and finding a bunch of the hidden chest. And when it's rupees, great. If it's a heart piece or something, even better. I enjoyed that. I did the Deku Sprout quest this time.
Nice, nice.
And do you want me to go into that since I think Matt wants to go on to it next week?
I'd prefer if you didn't. I don't want to get spoiled.
And I ain't going to say crap except for the fact that the time limit, because there is one, Matt.
It's 30 minutes. I did know that.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah, it's short on the GameCube. So I think you get 20 more minutes.
Whoa.
On the, it might not be
the potency of the water.
Sorry. Just, it is, you get 20 minutes in the GameCube version and you get 30 minutes in the Wii U version, which I would assume that 20 minutes is even more like nail biting when, once again, you don't have the Swift Sail.
Yes. So no Swift Sail and a shorter time limit. Yeah. So it's, you get 20 minutes for the GameCube. I found myself like, okay, I'm going to just have to, you know, restart this because I'm so close to not doing it. And then you'd finally get there like right at time. So I'm not going to ruin anything else for you, but that was kind of a nail biter for me. I enjoyed it. I went back and just played around on Windfall and kind of did all the other Windfall-y stuff you could catch up to. You guys have touched on most of it at this point. But most of that I just explored. I love going around. And now that you've got the hook shot, there are some islands that are, because with the grappling hook, you can only use it to do essentially the treasure digs.
Yep.
When you're on your ship, you can actually hookshot from your ship.
Oh, that's fun.
So there's some islands that are only accessible that way. And so I played around, did me a little exploration, and started getting me an island.
There you go.
So I didn't do as much between dungeons this week as I have in past weeks. I did spend some time sailing around and filling in map squares, picked up a few heart pieces and a few more rupees. There was one specific island that I wanted to mention that I had a really good time with, and it is in the lower – it is in the southeastern section of the Great Sea. It's in one of the lowest grid spaces you can get down there. I forget what the name of the island is. It's like Angular Island or – anyway, it's the one that it's just shaped like two squares, two perfect squares.
Okay.
And you sail up to it and it looks like just a bunch of blocks stacked on top of each other.
Oh, yeah. I did that one too.
Cool. And so you can get in there and it's got a secondary island that you can get over to with your Deku Leaf. And in that room, there is just a tall stack of blocks and a few platforms that you can't get to without getting up higher in the room. And what you basically got to do is move this giant stack of blocks in such a specific way with no guides telling you. It's not like there's like slots on the floor where blocks have to go or anything. You have to kind of mess around with them just enough to make a little stairs out of them. And it actually requires a little bit of thinking about. Then once you get that taken care of, you get to a chest. And I can't even remember if this gives you a heart piece or 100 rupees or what it gives you. But this was a fun little challenge. And to Josh's point about how some of these islands are very shrine-like, like Breath of the Wild shrine-like, this was a puzzle that felt very much like that to me.
Yeah. I did that one actually last week before we got the mirror shield. And there is a portion of that where you have to use a mirror shield to shine light around to slide right, by yeah, platforms. Yeah. So I didn't complete it. So I'm going to come back to it probably next week. But I'm very much looking forward to complete it because I did the blocks and moved them around a bit. And then I realized that I don't have everything I need to complete it. So I left before I completed it. And I'm looking forward to doing that one again. For me, I got all bomb bag upgrades. So I have 100 bombs now. I got all the wallet upgrades so I can carry 5,000 rupees. I got one, but not both of the quiver upgrades. So I have 60 arrows And I did some treasure hunting. So I was trying to pad my wallet a little bit. So I knocked off a few of my treasure charts that I have. I did a couple of the reefs that are in the shape of the dice. So I did a couple of those, pillaged the Moblin fortresses that are present there, which was, I really like that. Like, ship combat is really fun and like a kind of, it's not challenging, but like it's fun in a goofy kind of way. And like, I like it. It's fun.
So it was a little bit, I don't know how it is on the HD, but it was fun doing some of that ship combat without the aiming mechanic.
Yeah, that's
really
fair.
Large kind of like trading.
Like, shot for shot. Just like, yeah. All right, you went way over and I went way under. All right, let's get a little bit closer and see what happens.
So did you ever play that weird computer game that was probably more popular than ever Linda and I were in high school, where it was two bowmen? That would shoot like arrows.
Yes. So I did that. Also, World of Tanks is very similar to that. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I played games like that all the time. I love that.
Just that. It's me and some other guys crossing paths, missing each other's with bombs. I'll get you on the next round.
See also the tank mini game in Mario Party 2.
Yes. I know. Exactly. I enjoy it. It's fun.
Yeah. Cool. I think that's all that I had. Really not a big week for Bloopy Trails. So with all that said, let's move on to part five, which is Z targeting, where we talk about fascinating characters or enemies that we happen to cross. And Matt, I'm going to let you go first on this one. That was a noise. Damn.
We broke Matt.
I guess I'm going to have to go with Fado. Because he is a Kokiri, and Kokiri are really cool, and Wind Sage. Interesting that he uses a violin instead of an ocarina. That I think that would have been kind of neat to have an ocarina instead of a violin, but the violin works pretty well. I like it. He's kind of the more jolly sprite type character, unlike Mido the Grumpus, or Saria, who's, you know, very somber and sober, and you know, all of that is very interesting to me. It does bring into question the aspect of lineage within the Kokiri, about how Makar is apparently his descendant. So
like, what's the reproduction situation?
That's the question. That does bring in some questions that I have. But yeah, Fado was a pretty interesting character. I liked him.
So I was going to go with Fado, but you took him. Matt, you just straight took him from me.
I did. I took him right out from under your feet.
I'm going to go with Makar, and I'm going to bite on your little biological / spirit question there.
Mm.
So I feel like with the Zora to the... Shoot, what are we calling these people? The Rito.
Yeah, the Rito.
So Zora to Rito, I think, is going to be more of a biological
evolution.
Progression or evolution over time, right?
Yes.
So for some reason, the fish people decided that water wasn't great for them anymore.
Yep.
Don't want to get into that too much because I'm still bitter. But so you got bird people from that. And, you know, there's some kind of similarities in, you know, that they are made to traverse whatever whatever environment, you know, they come in contact with. I think with the Kokiri and the
Koroks.
Spirits of the forest, the Koroks, I think you're getting more into like a spiritual deal. Like, I don't know that they reproduce physically necessarily the same way, because, you know, they're always children,
right?
In the first rendition, like, do they ever actually reproduce, or is it like a when they die they reincarnate as the next version of themselves or something like that? So that's kind of my headcanon of maybe just as the spirits needed to change to be more viable, they changed into this.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. Thank you for that, Mike.
I really like the character design of Fado too. I think it's interesting because since you've got more detail to work with in this game than Ocarina of Time, you have this weird situation where, so obviously in Ocarina of Time, Link was intended to look exactly like the other Kokiri in terms of how he dresses, right?
Yes.
Because in that game, he was supposed to be one. At least at the beginning. And then with this game, what you don't want to have happen is have this character who's just like, oh, is that just like another Link? You know? But you've still got to pay homage to the design of the Kokiri in a way that's like reminiscent enough to get the point across. Mm-hmm. I think they rode that line really well, you know?
Yeah.
Where Fado's got this cool costume that is like, it is definitely reminiscent, and you can see the lineage of the Kokiri in like the hero's clothes, you know? But it's just a little bit, it's got just a little bit more going on with it.
Yeah. It's subtle, but, you know, I like that. And then I like, you know, with Makar, his instrument. I think that was a real high point for him.
Yeah,
just agreed. The music was great. The aesthetic of him playing it was also fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that Also, there's not a whole lot of characters in this particular bit, but
And I was actually, going to choose Fado too.
Fado gets the three-peat. Let's go.
Well, since I can't choose Fado, I'm going to go ahead and go with a character who has gotten a lot of discussion this episode, and that is the Arch Wizrobe.
Yay. A solid option. He really is a good one. The Wizrobe pinnacle. And it makes me wonder if he was, you know, like the up and coming, like maybe, you know, like dungeon employee of the month trying to get up to boss.
He wanted his own temple at some point.
Give him a little bit more time. He's like, I'll be the third, you know, escort temple.
Let's go. Also, I like the design of the Wizrobes in this game. They're bird-like, which I thought was a very interesting take on Wizrobes. Most of the time, they're like crinkly old men in large robes, but these ones are plumage and colorful birds that are just like dancing around and throwing fireballs.
You know what he kind of reminded me of is, was it Kamek in Mario?
Kamek.
Yeah. You know, the wizard Koopa that rides around on the broom.
Yeah.
I kind of got his vibe.
That's fair. Yeah, that's fair.
It's the one Mario enemy that made it into a Zelda game that wasn't Link's Awakening.
There you go.
Yeah. I really like just the design of the Wizrobes as well. We haven't really talked about that before, but just a further reminder that the enemy design and aesthetic in this game
is really excellent.
Is really cool.
It's excellent.
Someone had a really good time doing concepts and sketches and everything for all these characters.
The Prime Darknut as well, I thought was really, really cool with the black plate and the plumaged helm and his character markings are a little bit different. Once you strip all his armor off, the tattoos are slightly different. He's got the black fur instead of the white fur. Yeah, I thought all the Darknuts were really well done also.
Really want Darknuts to come back and Tears of the Kingdom.
Same. They also have some real Johnny Bravo stuff going on where they have no legs and just gigantic torsos. So that's fun.
Yeah. Okay. Well, with all that being said, let's move on to part six, which is final thoughts, where we let Matt wrap up this section of the game in as succinct a way as he can think to do.
So this section of the game continues to expand upon the excellent exploration that Wind Waker is really founded on. We get some excellent items in the game that help to traverse more of the world and solve more puzzles within the dungeon. We do have the introduction of our second sage in Fado, who's a fun little sprightly character. And we get to revisit Forest Haven Island and reconnect with our friend Makar, who is an excellent musician and just a fun little Grogu-esque character. Unfortunately, we have to tie off this section of the game with a really subpar dungeon that doesn't really scratch the itch and also has some of the least fun aspects of escort missions within it. But tying it all off with Linden's favorite boss fight and at least a excellent and unique boss music theme. But finally capping it off with the full restoration of the Master Sword, which we're looking forward to utilizing as we go throughout the rest of the game. And by the way, the Master Sword looks phenomenal.
I love carrying around like a white glowing Master Sword.
It's really fun. They did a great job with the Master Sword, I think, in this game. So tying it all off with the full restoration of the Master Sword. And looking forward to moving on next week to collect the Triforce of Courage for ourselves and then fighting the Evil King himself.
Well done, as always, Matt. That brings us to the end of the Sacred Realms Rundown for this week. We will be back next week with another installment of the Sacred Realms Rundown talking about another section of the game. Y'all, this has been a really great discussion. I've been enjoying it a ton, regardless of the fact that it's dropped about 10 degrees outside since we started recording.
Yes, it's now very cold.
Oh, yeah. It's a little chilly. I'm ready to go inside and warm up.
I might have lost some toes on this episode.
Toes. Yeah. Nah.
But, yeah, I really appreciate y'all having me back on. And it's been good to be back after a little bit of a hiatus with all our house moving and kiddo stuff.
Did you ever finish The Legend of Zelda?
No.
Did you ever find even a slight inkling of desire within your heart to try Zelda 2?
No. No, I did not. I needed about a 2-mini-game hiatus, but now I'm back and I hope to stay back. And this being probably the last episode that'll air before the new year, I hope that all the listeners of Sacred Realms have a fantastic new year's. May your 2023 be head and shoulders above your 2022 in whatever way, shape, or form it comes to. And happy holidays and happy new year.
absolutely co-sign that message. And of course, this will not be the last time that you hear from El Detective on this show. He will be joining us for his accustomed spot at the end of the season on our Rank and Recap episode once again.
Yes.
Can't wait. Can't wait. It's going to be a great time. We've got a little bit more game left to play before we get there, but it's coming to a head pretty soon. As we mentioned at the top of the episode, we will be putting up our next poll for voting on the next game, honestly, probably before the end of the week. So as of the time of listening to this episode, if you have any desire to vote on what game we play next, just a reminder that that can be done by any patron at any level subscribe to our Patreon, and that gets you access to the Discord channel as well. So it's going to be another top-down game, and we'll see what we get served up once the dust settles on that whole thing. So with all that being said, I think it's time to get out of here for the week. Matt, what do you think?
Let's do it. Let's go thaw out our toes and pack up our equipment, and then pack it in for a good week.
Sounds good. Gents, love talking to you. Mike, you're great.
Always.
Love you guys.
If you enjoyed today's show and you'd like a little extra Sacred Realms in your life, you can head over to patreon.com/sacredrealmspod and become a patron. If you've got no rupees, it is not a problem. 5-star Apple Podcast reviews are a great free way to support us. More reviews means that more people see our show. That makes us very happy, Hylians. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sacred Realms Pod for updates on the podcast and for behind the scenes action. Sacred Realms will be back next Wednesday with our thoughts on The Wind Waker Chapter 7. We'd love for you to play along with us and to share your thoughts on our social channels. The Wind Waker can be played in its original form on the Nintendo GameCube. It can be played in its HD remaster on the Nintendo Wii U, and it can be played on any device capable of running a Dolphin emulator. But in the meantime, may your hearts be full, may your arrows never miss. We'll catch y'all next time. Sacred Realms is an independent podcast production, which is produced, edited, and mixed by me, Lyndon Willoughby. Our music comes from Zelda and Chill by Mikkel and is graciously provided to us by Mikkel and Game Chops Records. Zelda and Chill is available to stream on Spotify or to purchase directly from GameChops.com. Finally, our thanks go to Nintendo for creating such exceptional and innovative experiences.